And I started working with this bunch of guys, and they're all very jolly. And we were considering what happens, how things, how organisms adapt to change. And when we talk about environmental change, this is kind of what you think about. You think about, oh, the ice is melting, which it is. And you think about global warming and storms and that sort of thing, and that's true. But the sort of thing that we were thinking about, well, yes, those things too, could also be on a quite a local scale. So we might be thinking about a tree that falls down in a forest, and where once the little plant was in shade, now it's in light. And that has changed the environment for that plant very significantly. There might be other kinds of change that we need to adapt to. We might have cyclical change, and we might, for example, if we're a plant, our seeds might need to be burnt before they can germinate. There might be seasonal change that we need to adapt to. Okay, so there's all these possible challenges that we need to adapt to. How do we do it? This is also what we tend to think about when we think about how organisms evolve, how they change. We think about Charles Darwin and genetic assimilation. So the fact, the selfish gene, the fact that successful genetic combinations should survive and so on. True, that's part of what we consider. But think about these creatures here. These are siblings. They are tadpoles of toads, I think. I always accidentally call them fish, which is very bad. And they are, they may even be genetically identical, but they're at least siblings. And they've grown up in very different environments. This one has grown up in a nutrient-poor environment, and this has grown up in a nutrient-rich environment. And you can see that there is a difference, right? So we also, within our lifetimes, make adaptations or change in response to our environment. And then the thing that we were really, really interested in was transgenerational plasticity. So could it be that organisms could make use of the information that their forebears had in adapting to the environment that they found, and in particular their mothers? And that's what I'm going to come on to talk about. And so that is just a cute picture with no hugely direct relevance, but you can't have too many cute pictures. Just like Cambridge colleges. Right. Okay, so we wanted to study maternal effects, and the maternal effects are defined as the influence of the maternal phenotype, that is the way that an organism is in the world. So the genotype is your set of genes. Your phenotype is what you make out of those genes, so kind of how you end up given your genes and the interaction with the environment. So we wanted to understand the influence of the maternal phenotype, so for example, body size, on her offspring, independent of the inherited genes. And you look puzzled and you think, well, how could that happen? But before I go on to exactly how, let's think about whether there's evidence for some of these things to happen. So going back to those plants that lived in the forest and there was a tree and it fell down, maybe they might have been American bellflowers. This is a kind of flower that grows in the forest, and it either grows in the understory, which is where you don't have light, so it's quite dark, or it grows in light gaps. And seedlings are more likely to germinate and survive if they're grown in the same light conditions as the maternal plant. So that's kind of interesting. These little critters, these are called springtails. They might not look cute, but they're quite interesting. They produce two generations a year, winter and summer, and so the offspring encounter the same environmental conditions as their grandparents did, and the age and weight and maturity are negatively correlated with those of the mother, so they're positively correlated with those of the grandparents, so that they are better able to survive in the environment that they will encounter. Okay, our original motivation for looking at this problem was to try to understand something that one of our collaborators was interested in particular, which is childhood obesity. And there was an episode in the Second World War called the Dutch Hunger Winter, and what happened there was that there was a famine, so a part of the Netherlands was blockaded under siege in the winter of 1944 to 1945, and it affected a very large number of people, 4.5 million people, and some of those people were pregnant women, just by random chance. And so there has been a cohort study that has followed and compared the children and the grandchildren of women who were pregnant during that period and women who were pregnant just before and just after. And the idea is to try and understand the effects of prenatal exposure to famine. And what was found was that if you are exposed during early gestation, this increases your stress response, risk of heart disease and schizophrenia, and that the women are at increased risk of obesity and breast cancer. So if you were in the womb and your mum was unfortunate enough to be starving during your early gestation, then these are the health consequences for you. And there are some other examples of where schizophrenia can be increased in the population owing to famine in the literature as well. If you're exposed at any stage, then you have a reduced glucose tolerance, and this is a risk factor for diabetes. We don't kind of understand this terribly well, but there seems to be greater reproductive success for women who were exposed during fetal development. And there are also grandparental effects. So the children of women who were exposed in late gestation are of lower birth weight. So these children would have been eggs in the baby, because the eggs are formed in the baby quite early on, during this famine. So these grandchildren were present as eggs inside the baby, inside the grandmother's womb during the famine, and then they end up being lower birth weight later on. And the babies have increased body fat. And the children of both prenatally exposed women and men, which is harder to understand because what was going on there, they didn't have eggs that were laid down, but anyway, they are of poorer health. So we wanted to try and understand these things. And in order to be useful to my biologist friends with the maths that I'm going to bring to this, I had to understand quite a lot of biology. And so that's why I'm going to tell it to you now, because I've learnt it and I think it's important that I carry it on and I expose you all to biology. Why not? Okay. How could it happen? How could these things happen? Some of these things are a little bit scary. You won't be able to unhear them afterwards, so just I'm warning you. Epigenetic marks. This is something that you might have heard of, epigenetics. It's quite sort of trendy at the moment. And what it says is that it's not only our genes that are important, it's how our DNA is modified around our genes that changes how those genes are expressed and therefore the effect that they have in us. And there's different ways that that can happen. You can modify some histones, you can put, you can methylate bits of DNA. That's the one that sometimes people have heard of. So basically, things get stuck on or twisted around, or shapes are changed slightly, and that affects how your genes are expressed. Now, there's a sort of interesting crossover thing going on here, because this DNA methylation might ultimately lead to some kind of heritable changes. So we found that if there was a methylation arising, if there's a methylation arising from a single change in generation zero of a mouse, this can be transmitted faithfully to four generations of descendants. That's kind of interesting. And actually, I have a colleague who has worked on Daphnia, and I think he has seen heritability for something like 16 generations. So it's quite remarkable, this change that can come around, can arise in your DNA through environmental factors, so things like being stressed in some way. I don't mean sort of stressed, anxious stress particularly. I tend, you know, some kind of biological stress. It could be emotional stress, but it could be other things like, for example, the famine. One of the DNA bases, cytosine, is particularly prone to mutation if it's methylated, and that's because it can revert into one of the other bases when the methyl group comes off. And if you've got one DNA change, then you can't tell which one it should be. Like if it changed into something that wasn't a DNA base, that would be fine. But if it changes into something that is a different DNA base, then the DNA repair mechanism that we all have in us can't tell which bit's wrong. So you can get a mutation that way that stays. And that this is then a possible route to change from, or to encode environmental stresses that are temporary, or temporary modifications to the DNA, to encode them as a genetic change.
Last question. So how is methylation affected by stress on the organism itself?
You get all these methylation marks and various other things that go on in your DNA through kind of responses to the environment. Now, how it, there'll be all kinds of signalling pathways that ultimately do that sort of thing, and I don't know the whole route. But as I'm about to show you, they can have these slightly scary effects. Yeah. And so we've all got these, and they come on, and they often can be removed as well, but yeah, they can also be passed down. Right. Resource transmission. So that aside, we can also give things to our children in the womb, for example. So we can give them, and we do give them, resources to grow. Or if we're a bird, we would do that in their egg yolk. And other things get transmitted that way too, like hormones. We provide our children with parental care. That's another way in which we can influence them. And for humans, we also provide them with learning and culture, and that's a way in which we influence not only our children, but other people's children as well. Okay, these mechanisms are interconnected. These epigenetic marks that can arise in response to environmental stresses, so starvation, for example, lack of normal parental care, they can be related to each other. So a lack of maternal licking and grooming behaviour in rats, which is kind of the rat equivalent of cuddling your baby, can lead to differences in DNA methylation, and then in mice to differences in adult stress responses and licking and grooming of their own pups. So you might have a sort of faulty behaviour and then an epigenetic response to that. And then in response to that epigenetic change, the behaviour change in the next generation is kind of repeated, and so on. And for example, the transmission of hormones in the egg yolk can interact with parental care. So I give the mother bird gives the baby bird some hormone, and that then influences her own response to the baby bird later. Quite often people ask me for equal opportunities, maternal effects. They say, are there any paternal effects? And there are. There don't seem to be as many as for maternal effects, but there are some. And these are some of the ones that I find slightly more alarming. There are some nice things where you can the fathers transfer beneficial substances. Daddy Blennyfish transfer antimicrobial compounds to the brooded eggs. Fathers provide parental care, and epigenetic marks can be passed down. And here's an example of one which is, I think, quite frightening. So the offspring and grand offspring of male mice that are trained to fear the smell of a certain chemical, acetophenone, are more likely to startle when they are exposed to the smell. And the mechanism there seems to be sperm DNA hypomethylation. And so essentially you're frightening one lot of adult father mice, and then their children and their grandchildren are frightened of that smell, never having been exposed to that smell before. Anyway, okay, so there are these things that go on. The maths is the same, because the maths is equal opportunities, doesn't really care if you're a male or a female. Right, there are also grandparental effects. I won't go into that. Okay, and then the questions that we had were, how do these kinds of effects influence adaptation to environmental change, and under what circumstances would we expect these kind of effects to evolve? Okay, so here, having kind of understood at least some of that, then I was kind of in a position to start to apply some maths. And we looked at a number of ways of doing it. It was nice to have a big group. We did a bunch of interacting kinds of analyses, and the bit that I did was quantitative genetics. And so, for quantitative genetics, I need to construct a phenotype for an offspring. And I say that the phenotype takes into account the genes that are inherited from the mum and dad, the environment that the offspring experiences, the maternal effects of the maternal effects that come solely from the mother. So this here is the mother's phenotype in generation T-1. This is the response of her daughter in generation T. And you see that I'm making up the offspring phenotype that is also called Z in generation T. So I've got genes, environment, maternal effects, and then kind of everything we haven't managed to think of yet that we consider to be random and normally distributed and have zero mean, because that's what you always assume. And God help us if any of those things are not true. I assume that they aren't true in general, but somehow some of these general principles do seem to carry through. Right. Okay, so what we were doing really, we were adding this bit to a well-understood model. So we were saying, if we don't only respond to the genes and the environment, but we also respond to mum and her phenotype, what happens? Okay, and I've said all that. Then, in order to understand what happens, you have to ascribe a fitness to a particular kind of phenotype. And the fitness can describe either how likely you are to die or how likely you are to reproduce. And we look here at mortality selection, so I'm really looking at how likely is a person to survive to be old enough to breed. And you give that person a fitness based on their phenotype. And we make it Gaussian. That's another of the things that you always do in quantitative genetics. And you say that the environment defines some optimal phenotype that it would like you to be, or that is best for surviving in that environment. And then here are some costs of being able to adapt. So that's a little bit of a subtlety. We can ignore that a little bit if you like. But the idea is that you will be fittest if your Z matches theta, which is what the environment says you should be like in order to survive most effectively. There are a lot of assumptions here that I will skip over. Okay, right, so there is, in quantitative genetics, what you find is that you can use this fitness to work out the per generation change in population mean components of that fitness. So each individual had a fitness like I just showed you, but we've got lots of individuals in the environment, and so we integrate over a population distribution of those characters, and we get a population mean that looks like this. This is just a Gaussian probability distribution. And then we want to look and see how things change over one generation. And so you can take a gradient of the log of the mean fitness and do some calculations, and you find that in the end you get a relationship with the change over a single generation of the characters of the traits that are giving you the fitness. Okay, so this is natural selection. So when all that thing about natural selection, you know, the fittest survive and so on, this is kind of the maths of the fittest surviving. And it's a bit fiddly, but you can follow it all through, and it does seem to work like this. So, and we had an expression for W bar, and so we can then work out this change over time. And so we put in our expression for W bar, and we have some sums, and they look like this, and all the biologists found this totally horrifying, and actually, to an extent, I kind of agreed with them. Some of it wasn't very nice. But nonetheless, we're able to work out how the contribution from the genes, the contribution from the response to the environment, and the contribution from the response to the mother's phenotype would change over the generations. Okay, and then this response, this change, is going on in response to an environment that is fluctuating in some way. And we consider a couple of different scenarios. Firstly, we consider what might happen if we lived in a very benign environment and there was a sudden change. So we had an environment and then after a while it hopped up to a different value. And that environmental variable might be something like temperature, for example, but it could be something else. It could be like food availability or something like that. And the other thing that we might want to think about is a periodically fluctuating environment. So we might have seasonal change, and that again could change temperatures and food availability and other things that allow us to survive or not. And so we considered this kind of environmental change where we have a sinusoid. Okay, so some of the sums that are hidden in all of this were quite tricky, and it took a long time to do. So to start with, we said, well, okay, what if everybody had the same response to their mum and it was the same over all time? That made it much easier to do the calculations, and we got some interesting outcomes. If you think about some real examples of maternal effects, you find for body size in mice, for juvenile growth in red squirrels, for age at maturity in springtails, and for clutch size in collared flycatchers, that the maternal effect is negative, which means that all other things being equal, the offspring is unlike its mother. And the offspring being unlike its mother is puzzling, because the idea is that the mother should be encoding some information within her that gives a survival advantage in the environment that the offspring finds itself in. So why is that not really the case? Why does that not happen? Okay, so let's think about what would be happening if I had a positive maternal effect. So all other things being equal, I would be like my mum. Then that would mean that if Granny was a little bit taller than she should have been, a little bit over height, a bit over optimal, then once I'd added up all the genes and the effect of the environment and so on, I'd be adding an extra bit to account for Granny's extra height. So I would be even higher. And similarly, So my mum would be even higher, and similarly I would be even taller than my mum. And if it were the other way round, if Granny were a little bit below height, then mum would be a little bit shorter than that, and I would be even shorter than that. And you can see that over time this might have a deleterious effect. On the other hand, if maternal effects are negative, then if my granny was tall, my mum might be a little bit shorter than average, and then I might be a little bit taller than average, but it might even itself out over the generations. And although it's more complicated than that, and I've skipped over a lot of things, that's sort of, in a nutshell, kind of what it boils down to. So if you look to see what happens, if you make a sudden change at time zero in your environmental state, and you look to see what happens to your phenotype, and you allow only positive maternal effects, what you find is that the phenotype recovers very quickly and adapts very quickly if you have positive maternal effects. And the fitness recovers very quickly if you have positive maternal effects. But the more positive your effects are, the lighter grey you are. And so you can see that there is a price to pay in the long term. So you adapt very rapidly to your new environment, but something doesn't quite go right in the longer term. Okay, so we have this reduced fitness at equilibrium. And so you want to try and understand, well, why is that? So let's let our environment be stable for a while. Instead of having it make a jump, we'll just fix it at some value delta. Then I can work out the expected phenotypic variance at equilibrium. There's a complicated thing that I have to do to get that, but I can work it out in terms of M. And you can see from this expression that this is going to be minimized when M is negative. And that's because I've got something plus M on the top and lots of things minus M on the bottom. And even though that's a minus M squared, still this thing on the top is what makes the big difference. So, if I have a negative M, I've got less phenotypic variance. Well, so what? Well, it turns out that the population mean fitness goes like 1 over the square root of that variance, or 1 over the square root of 1 plus that variance. And so where you have a lot of variance, you have low fitness. So if you want to maximize your fitness, you should have low variance and a negative maternal effect. And if we relate that back to what was going on with the grannies and the mums and the daughters, you can see that if you had positive maternal effects, you'd get lots of tall people and lots of very short people, whereas you'd have a lot of medium-sized people with negative maternal effects. And so you would have, for positive maternal effects, you'd have a lot of population who lay a long way from the optimal phenotype, whereas with negative maternal effects, you have this stabilizing feature that brings the phenotype on average closer to what's optimal for that environment. Okay, and if you want to look at that on the individual level, which biologists tend to because that's where evolution operates, what's going on here is that with positive maternal effects, this offspring is integrating the two pieces of information that she gets from the genes and the maternal effects, and she's taking both pieces of information from her mother and using them in the same direction. And so she's overcompensating. She's overusing that piece of information. Whereas, if she uses them against each other using a negative maternal effect, she can trade off the body size, for example, that she gets from her mum against the genes for body size that she gets from her mum and hopefully stay somewhere a little bit more close to the average. Okay, and so we thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if we could do those calculations that had been very complicated to allow the maternal effect to evolve over time? Wouldn't it be nice if it showed that in stable environments you had a negative maternal effect, and then when there was a change in the environment you had a positive maternal effect, and then it went back to being stable and negative again? And it was really nice when that happened. So it did take 2 years. So that is what happens. You see that you have a nice stabilizing negative maternal effect in a stable environment. The maternal effect evolves to be positive at the environmental change, which allows rapid adaptation to that environmental change, and then drops back again to being negative when that extra adaptation is no longer needed. We also did some work on predictable and unpredictable environmental change, and to boil it down to a nutshell, what we found was that you get positive maternal effects favoured when environmental change is more predictable and you can adapt fast enough. And we did that by looking at a predictable sinusoidal change compared to stochastic flipping between two different environments. And then some people did some experiments in nematode worms where they subjected them to predictable and unpredictable patterns of environmental change. And very pleasingly, they did find that the predictably fluctuating environment led to the evolution of a maternal effect. And in this case, they were looking at the ability of the worm to survive in low oxygen conditions. And they showed that there was an adaptive maternal glycogen provisioning that allowed that to happen. And that's that. There's a lot of maths in there, but we tell the story that relates to the biology, and that is the way to cross that boundary. And so very often a lot of the maths is hidden in supplementaries and long pages of calculations that the biologists don't read, but it's all there in gory detail if you would like to read it. And I think that's it. That's it.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Yes. Firstly, I would like to thank you for also sharing the little bits of UCE that were not so happy and not so nice.
You're welcome.
And I would just like to ask about the interpretation of your negative maternal effects. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about cross-generational competition. Could that also be, if you're like your mom, then there's probably more cross-generational competition, at least in animals, that live longer than just a year. But if you're unlike your mom, like, say, if you have a different fur pattern or something, then you might have an advantage.
That could also be true, and it's sort of true in the case of those springtails, where they're actually, the mums and the grandparents are existing in different environments. It could be true. The reason that I'm sort of slightly demurring is that if you wanted to do the maths of that, that would be an extra thing. You would have to have it that there might be, if you like, niches for different phenotypes. And actually, biologists do quite a lot of models like that, where they have, for example, two environments, one that favours one kind, one that favours another kind, and where you look at migration and then maternal effects as well within that. So you've got little patch models and you send your offspring off to live in a different environment that might favour you but not your mum or something. So you can do that, but it just makes it more complicated. And in the real world, what's happening, it's often quite complicated. You're often mediating via different traits. So what we're saying is that we're bringing an extra perspective that people might not have thought about, which is that this can act as a stabilisation mechanism, but there are lots of other things too, for sure.
Other questions? I have a quick question. So the stability results that you showed, are they... So you said you were hiding a lot of mathematics. Are they... So you studied the stability of the dynamical system that you get, or
yes, we did in some circumstances. So it depends. So with the fixed maternal effects, yeah, we did look at some stability results. They weren't as helpful as I kind of hoped they might be, having started out working in dynamical systems. So to be honest, we didn't kind of follow that route very far, but you can potentially.
Yeah.
By the time you're doing the evolving maternal effects, really, it's not that helpful, and you need to do numerical simulation. But
I mean, everything becomes non-autonomous.
So. Yeah, and also you've got even non-ergodic behaviour, which is slightly problematic.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Rebecca again for fascinating.